You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. Oh, man, last night it was nuts.
Let them die.
Jeff Holtzman of the Talk Radio News Service was on the site, on the scene in Tampa, talkradionews.com, of course. And Jeff's Twitter is Jeff, G-E-O-F-F, Holtzman, H-O-L-T-Z-M-A-N, 1. Jeff, welcome to the program.
Hey, Tom, good to be with you.
Great to have you back with us. I'm curious, you know, this Ron Paul, let me just play the clip here. This is Ron Paul.
A healthy 30-year-old young man has a good job, makes a good living, but decides, you know what, I'm not going to spend $200 or $300 a month for health insurance because I'm healthy, I don't need it. But, you know, something terrible happens, all of a sudden he needs it. Who's going to pay for it if he goes into a coma,
well,
for example?
Who
pays for that?
In a society that you accept welfareism and socialism, he expects the government to take care of it.
What do you want?
But what he should do is whatever he wants to do and assume responsibility for himself. My advice to him would have a major medical policy, but not before.
But he doesn't have that. He doesn't have it, and he needs intensive care for 6 months. Who pays?
That's what freedom is all about, taking your own risk. This whole idea that you have to prepare and take care of everybody.
But, Congressman, are you saying the society should just let him die?
No. Yeah.
And at that point, the audience starts yelling, yes. Did I hear that right? Is that an accurate reflection of the perspective?
I think you did, Tom. I think you did. And that's sure the way that sounded to me. I'm really at a loss for words to sort of analyze that response to that question and what it means. But I think it's you that Ron Paul, you know, he's got a lot of ideas on a lot of different issues, but I think at the end of the day, that's why he's not a viable candidate to win the nomination. Now, it's interesting, though, because he does poll fairly well in these polls that come out.
Sure.
In fact, the last poll that I found, the CNN ORC poll, he was in the top 5.
Yeah.
So he's obviously got a large...
Oh, he's number 2 in the Iowa straw poll, although Fox News refused to name his name for an hour and a half. It's like they're deciding who's won. Media Matters this morning has a really interesting piece about how all the Fox talking heads this morning have been talking about how Romney won the debate, and they're quoting other news sources as saying that. And yet many of the people there didn't think that at all. What was your sense of you were there. What was your sense of the Tea Party crowd and their thinking on who won the debate?
Well, first of all, I hate this whole win or lose thing at these debates. I mean, I think.
But at the end of the day, this is about winning the nomination to be president of the United States. So there is a piece of that, isn't there?
That's true. I mean, the way I look at it is this: I talked to a number of voters, self-described Tea Party voters, yesterday, who sounded skeptical about Rick Perry. To be honest with you, I talked to one gentleman from Orlando who told me that he believes that the hype around Rick Perry is simply a creation of the media, and that he needs to see more. And based on what Rick Perry did last night, I think the jury is still, it has to still be out for a lot of these folks. I mean, he got attacked pretty viciously from all sides. Some of the lesser tier candidates, according to the polls, you know, Michelle Bachmann, Mr. Paul himself, and Rick Santorum went after Perry pretty hard, and I thought deservedly so, on, for instance, the HPV vaccine that he signed into law. I think I think that's a no-brainer. But, you know, Congresswoman Bachwoman came at it from the standpoint of, you know, that's not limited government. That's government interference in people's health care decisions.
Right, which is kind of a variation on the don't put fluoride in the water, and I'm actually ambivalent about that one. We're talking with Jeff Holtzman, a reporter with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Jeff, I want to get back to Ron Paul. The libertarian logic behind this is that if somebody doesn't make decisions about themselves and take care of themselves and plan for their own contingencies, then they do deserve to die. And that argument was made when back in the 60s, it was in my lifetime, when there was a huge debate about whether or not people should be required to have car insurance. And the Republican position or the conservative position was no. You know, if people shouldn't have to have car insurance, I mean, you know, but the problem was, what happens if I'm uninsured and I hit your car And, you know, you have a claim against me, but I got no money and I'm uninsured. And so that's where this whole liability insurance came from. And that was the first requirement. That was the first step in requiring car insurance. Then, of course, the insurance lobby got in and said, oh, well, let's require even more than that. Although in some states it is just liability insurance. Isn't there, with regard to health care, an analogy here? I mean, if we want to believe Ron Paul's position that everybody should simply make their own decisions, and if somebody is 30 years old and thinks he's going to live forever, decides not to get health care, but he has active tuberculosis and he can't figure out why he's coughing and he's creating an epidemic, isn't that the same thing as his car running into my car?
Well, Tom, I mean, he probably should have thought of that before he got tuberculosis, don't you think?
Okay, so that would be the Ron Paul position.
Well, yeah, I mean, I'm being facetious, but yeah, I mean, I think that's where Congressman Paul is coming from, and you know, I mean, make of it what you will. That's kind of what he's all about. It's this extreme libertarian position where, you know, it's all about personal responsibility in every single aspect of life, and it's sort of damned if you do, damned if you don't. I haven't seen that to that extent from the other candidates so far. I mean, obviously you have Congresswoman Bachman who's saying, you know, she's going to do everything she can to repeal the health care law. She hasn't been asked, you know, what are you going to do instead of the health care law? Are you going to replace it with something of your own, or are you just going to repeal it and then leave it?
Right.
That hasn't been asked. I'd like to hear that asked. In terms of the other candidates, we know Mitt Romney has already passed in a health care law with an individual mandate in it. So I think that he would stand on the opposite end from Ron Paul.
Sure. They are the polar opposites. I'm fascinated by this dynamic of Roger Ailes being the Republican kingmaker and Fox News being the portal through which all Republican candidates over the last decade have had to pass, and probably Ronald Reagan wouldn't have made it through. But the idea that it appears that the Republican establishment, the Wall Street Republican establishment, that pretty much the Republican Party doesn't want anybody to know exists. You know, they want everybody to look at the Tea Party while the Wall Street Party is really running the Republican Party, has decided that Mitt Romney's their guy. And Fox News is going all out for Mitt Romney as their guy. Is the grassroots talking about that in those terms, or am I just seeing that in the progressive blogs?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think that's something that's really bothering folks in the Tea Party, at least in places that I've gone to outside the Beltway, you know, down here in Florida and, of course, in Iowa and New Hampshire. That's something that they're not really fond of, is the fact that they're sort of getting their candidate dictated to them, you know, by the, you know, the big media, by big business. And they want to put an end to it. I just don't know if they're going to be able to succeed, because right now, you know, in conversations that I've had with Tea Party voters, they don't really have a clear-cut favorite. And I think that in order for them to actually have a viable shot at pushing their agenda, they have to have, you know, a clear-cut candidate who is going to have a shot at the nomination. You can talk about Michelle Bachman. You know, you can talk about a guy like Herman Cain. But at the end of the day, I don't think they're just going to – I don't think
they want to beat Obama.
I'm sorry?
At the end of the day, they want to beat Obama.
They want to beat Obama, but at the same time, they're worried that, you know, say if a guy like Mitt Romney wins, he's not going to represent their full interests.
But if Marco Rubio was his VP?
That's true, although I haven't heard a lot of buzz about that this weekend. I was frankly kind of surprised. A lot of folks, you know, it's kind of debatable whether he needs more time in office and needs to build himself more of a national profile. I don't know.
Yeah, well, they said that about Barack Obama, and he won the presidency. So
That's true.
Yeah.
I don't think the GOP has a Barack Obama, though, yet.
Well, I would put my money on Marco Rubio as the VP candidate. I think, but we'll see. I mean, time will play out, and I bet anything that Romney's going to be the candidate. He's got so much money and so much power. And now, obviously, Fox, you know, Sarah Palin is supporting him, you know, by attacking Perry, Karl Rove. I mean, the whole institution. Jeff Holtzman with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Thank you, Jeff.
Thanks, Tom.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
We'll be back. There's a lot more going on than just the Tea Party, although that was very entertaining, this debate. Well, let me share some clips with you and we'll continue.
As the tea was going overboard, they said it's time to party. Stir it up, show the man what we made of.
You know, the really important thing about last night's Tea Party debate is that or Republican debate, let's call it. Because, you know, the Tea Party, you know, one of the folks in the chat room made the point, Tea Party? Come on, there is no Tea Party. This is an invention of billionaires. This is a made-for-media event by the Koch brothers and Dick Armey. I mean, you know, come on. But as it were, actually what happened was, you know, they did create a large grassroots movement that did infiltrate the Republican Party and has, you know, started out as a third party and has become a third party within the Republican Party. And frankly, I think the progressives need to do the same thing in the Democratic Party. But the larger point here is that what we saw last night in the CNN so-called Tea Party debate was a glimpse into what America would become if a Republican, any Republican, whether it's Mitt Romney or Rick Perry or any of them, beats Barack Obama in 2012. And that's the problem. And frankly, well, for example, clip number four. Here, this is Rick Perry and Mitt Romney mixing it up on Social Security. But we know, you know, they're really at a certain level, they're talking in code. Mitt Romney's saying, "Stop scaring people. We're going to screw up. We're going to take out Social Security. Don't you worry." But you don't say it out loud, you idiot. Here's the clip.
If what you're trying to say is that back in the 30s and the 40s that the federal government made all the right decisions, I disagree with you. And a program that's been there 70 or 80 years, obviously we're not going to take that program away. But for people to stand up and support what they did in the 30s or what they're doing in the 2010s is not appropriate for America.
Do you still believe that Social Security should be ended as a federal program as you did 6 months ago when your book came out? And return to the states.
I think we ought to have a conversation.
We're having that right now, Governor.
We're
running for president.
I'll finish this conversation.
Yeah. And then he, actually, that clip runs a little longer, and then he throws it back to Mitt Romney and says, "You said that it would be a crime if a private corporation did what Social Security does." And then Mitt Romney says, "No, I didn't say that in my book. What I said was that it would be a crime if a private corporation had the power to tax or some variation on that." I'm not sure anybody ever really got the Mitt Romney response to that. And it's very interesting how that clip is going to be sliced and diced, particularly on conservative talk shows, depending on whether they've chosen to promote Romney or Perry, because you could play it either way. But the fact of the matter is that at the end of, you know, fact of the matter, end of the day, sorry about the cliches, But I don't know another way to say it. Really, the bottom line, cliche number three, what's really going on here is that Wall Street is looking at a $2.7 trillion surplus in the Social Security Trust Fund. Social Security is going to be fine. If you're 25 years old, you're going to have Social Security. I mean, this is a program that has existed for 70 years and worked just fine. And it's going to continue to work for another 30 years. Back in the 60s, they were saying Social Security is going to be broke in the 70s. Back in the 70s, they were saying it's going to be broke in the 80s. Back in the 80s, they were saying it's going to be broke in the 90s. Now they're saying it's going to be broke in the 2030s. It's not. This is just, you know, over and over. So, but $2.7 trillion? And you got banksters on Wall Street who have so much money that they could make somebody president? I mean, Barack Obama spent a little less than $1 billion. I think it was $800 million in the last presidential campaign to win the presidential campaign. You take the top 10 Wall Street hedge fund managers with an average income of $2 billion a year apiece. That's $20 billion. If each one of them kicked in, let's see, to get $1 billion out of $20 billion, that's 5%. So if each one kicked in 5% of their income, if their income is $2 billion, that would be $10 million. Am I doing my math right? Or $100 million? Let's say it's $100 million. Yeah, I think it would be $100 million each, which is nothing. I mean, you know, it's $100 million to somebody making $2 billion a year, $2,000 million a year. It's a week or two's worth of income to end up with a $2.7 trillion pie that you can slice up and skim off the top of? I mean, that's not supporting a presidential candidate. That's making an investment in your future income. So this, and of course, we can't have a jobs plan We can't have anything that's going to allow the economy to recover. Now the president has come out with his jobs plan. Yeah, there's pieces of it you can debate. I'm not real happy about the fact that he's put into it these free trade deals. But I still think on net, pass the whole damn thing, right? But here's on Fox News, clip 5. This is Steve Doocy. This is Soak the Rich, right?
The corporate jet thing is going to raise $3
billion.
That's it. That's 1/100th of what the kind of money they need. So even though the president of the United States last Thursday said, you know, there's not going to be any class warfare. Once again, it is class warfare. It's one of those soak the rich things.
Yeah, because, see, if you're rich, if you're Bill O'Reilly and you have a private jet, or you're Fox News and frankly, I don't know which of these have private jets. I know, you know, most of the banks have private jets. If you're Jamie Dimon and you've got a private jet, you get to depreciate that thing over 5 years. Airlines have to depreciate their jets over 7 years. In other words, you get to reduce the taxes that you pay. You get to increase the cut against your profit more rapidly if you're a private corporation or an individual. If you're a rich guy or a corporation, other than an airline. So, Steve Doocy, it's not soak the rich. It's let the rich pay the same as everybody else. Why should a billionaire, why should Warren Buffett, you know, get a tax break on his corporate jet when United Airlines doesn't? Please make sense out of this for me. 27 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
I just find the entire thing amazing. And Bobby Jindal. I got to tell you about Bobby Jindal. Welcome back, Tom Hartman here with you. You will recall Joplin, Missouri was back in May. This is September. May, June, July, August, September. People are waiting for federal assistance. The state does not have the money. The community is wiped out. They are not the only ones, by the way. There's a whole bunch of them. FEMA and the federal government are estimating probably $30-35 billion worth of, of major damage has happened. A lot of that will be covered by insurance companies. A lot of it will simply be sucked up by homeowners and property owners and business owners. But the infrastructure damage, the stuff that really needs to be done and fixed now, the roads, the bridges, the hospitals, schools, the government buildings, communication systems and towers, all those kind of things, they need to be paid for. So the Democrats submitted a $7 billion disaster relief package for victims of recent climate disasters to the Senate yesterday. I think this is the most underreported story in America right now. $7 billion they asked for. Now, keep in mind, $7 billion is what we spend, in a week or so? Maybe 2 weeks in Iraq and Afghanistan, all on the national credit card. So they said, let's spend $7 billion rebuilding these communities. It got 53 votes in the Senate, which would be, I would guess, pretty much every Democrat. Well, not even every Democrat. But the Republicans and a few crazycrats blocked the thing, saying, no, the Republicans declared that they were going to filibuster it. And they are to, so if you live in the Midwest, if you live in a state that has been hit as a victim of one of these natural disasters, guess what? The Republicans do not want you to have anything. Now, here's another one that I found really, really interesting. Ever since Reagan, there has been this pervasive belief in the United States that somehow if you had private corporations doing things that typically have been done and probably should be done by the government, it would be cheaper. Now, they weren't buying that back in World War II. I mean, you had soldiers peeling potatoes famously. You know, KP duty. Washing out latrines. Mopping floors. Painting buildings. Soldiers did all that. Why? Well, A, they're not paid that much, so it's cheap labor. B, they're there. Let's put them to work. C, if it happens to be in a combat zone like Iraq or Afghanistan, the guy who's dishing out the mashed potatoes at 1 minute, if a firefight erupts, can pick up his gun and go out and fight in the second minute. So, I mean, we've always known that at least in the military, it was cheaper to simply have the military do things. Although, you know, consider the insanity of the fact that right now in Iraq and Afghanistan, we have more contractors than we do GIs in both countries. But it goes beyond that. I mean, the corporations have been saying for years and years, oh, you know, you want roads built? Hire private corporations. You want bridges built? You know, hire private corporations. You want Social Security administered? Give it to Wall Street. You want Medicare? Give it to United Healthcare. Well, in fact, they did to a large extent with Medicare Part B. And C and D. I'm waiting for Medicare Part E, E for everybody. But now the Project on Government Oversight did a study. Somebody's actually crunched the numbers. And guess what? Common sense prevails. I mean, don't you think, doesn't it just kind of make sense that if you're taking a function of government, you know, making sure that Yellowstone works as a place that people can visit, where the wildlife is protected and the people are protected, or Central Park in New York. Yeah, I mean, you fill in the blank, right? Some legit, our public schools, our police departments, our fire departments. And one of the areas where you can make real clear side-by-side comparisons is about half of all the electricity in the United States is generated by public utilities, publicly owned by cities, towns, counties, townships, in some cases states. And about half of all the electricity in the United States is generated by private corporations. So you can compare apples to apples. Same with sanitation systems, same with water systems. Now, if a private corporation is providing those services, they've got to not only provide the service like a government agency would have to do, but, you know, in a government agency, there's got to be a boss, right, or a head of agency. Okay, so that's another, what, $80,000-$90,000 a year, whatever it is that senior people in the government make these days, $100,000, fill in the blanks. Maybe it's $50,000. These days, I don't know. But if you've got a corporation, you got to have a CEO who's got a $10 million a year salary. You got all these stockholders who all want a dividend every month so that they can make their living sitting around the pool on their butts waiting for the dividend checks to arrive and pay a maximum 15% income tax. You've got to have, you know, layers of senior management. You got to have marketing. You got to have lobbyists who got you the gig in the first place. You have to have salespeople who put together the presentations to make, you know, hey, this is because we're competing against three of the. So how is that going to lower the costs? Turns out it doesn't. The Project on Government Oversight found that on average, when you take a public function, a road, for example, and hand it over to a private corporation, a toll road, you know, let's run a toll road, the cost doubles. Doubles. We could save a fortune in the end. You've got all these Republicans. You know, one of the core themes and threads that ran through the Republican debate last night, and that runs through all the Republican debates, is we got to shrink government. Okay, well, there's a lot of things that need to be done. You know, last night I heard, I think it was Ron Paul say, you know, get rid of the Department of Education, get rid of FEMA, get rid of the Department of, you know, fill in the blanks, right? All of them. Okay, so you're going to do what? Replace them with private corporations? You're going to double the costs. Now, if we pay for that with our tax dollars, you're going to double the size of government. You want to cut the size of government? Just make it illegal to hire private contractors. Or not even necessarily illegal. Just say, you know, you must demonstrate before you give a contract to Blackwater that it is going to cost less than if enlisted men and women in the Army did the same function. If you're going to privatize part of Medicare, you've got to prove that it would be less expensive. And they can't prove it. It won't be possible. And they'll say, oh, well, you know, government has an advantage. They got those buildings that they built back in the 50s during Eisenhower's administration, and they don't have to pay rent on those, and private corporations have to pay rent. Well, okay. Compete with that. I mean, shouldn't we be saying, this is our government, we the people, the first three words of the Constitution, we created this thing, we're going to make it work? Do you get the bizarre logic that's being promoted by the Republicans? This idea that anything that is done can be done more efficiently through competition in the free marketplace. Now, in some areas, that is absolutely true. Although the transistor, you know, yeah, it was originally developed by Bell Labs, but the pre-development, the stuff that made the development of it possible came out of the National Academy of Sciences. The same with most pharmaceuticals and on and on and on. I mean, you know, the government is like starting a lot of things. But, you know, the fact of the matter is I'm not suggesting that the government should get in the business of making computers and competing with Dell or Apple. That's not a function of the commons. I am suggesting that the government should make sure that none of these companies get so large that they don't have competitors. Because then you end up with a situation like we have in the United States, where on average we pay five times more than any European country pays for broadband access and for cable TV access and for telephone access. Why? Because in Europe, they don't allow large monopolies. You know, the European Union busted Microsoft as a monopoly. They don't allow large monopolies. Why? Because they actually believe in competition. Those socialist countries, they believe in competition. But when it comes to the commons, they also do it themselves.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And we should, too. And wait until you hear who is the fastest growing group that is declaring bankruptcy in America right now, right after this. Talk Media for the rest of us. Welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program. And David Vines is on the line with us. David is a political science major at the University of Wisconsin and reporter and blogger for the Huffington Post, huffingtonpost.com/David-Vines, Twitter at David Vines. David, welcome back to the program.
Hey, Tom. It's good to be back. Thanks for having me again.
Great to have you with us. I teased this as I was going to the last break. Right at the moment, and I think this is a perfect segue, they have calculated who is the largest cohort. What's the fastest growing group of people declaring bankruptcy right now in the United States? It's college graduates, and in large part because they're graduating with huge debt, and they have no job prospects. And in the midst of this, the University of Wisconsin is it sued, or is this guy just yelling and screaming?
Well, I just got out of the press conference, as a matter of fact, and there are about 200 people, students, who you might be able to hear in the background right now. This is the Center for Equal Opportunity. They are not suing the university because, of course, the university is not doing anything illegal. as upheld by the Bakke case and the two University of Michigan cases, because we are not using quotas. That being said, what they're trying to do is they're trying to pressure, and he said this himself, they're trying to pressure the university into rethinking their affirmative action policies.
Okay, let's establish, first of all, the Center for Equal Opportunity and Roger Clegg, according to SourceWatch, is not exactly, an equal opportunity group. They are, their protest is that they're threatening to sue the University of Wisconsin for not admitting enough white people.
Yes, that is correct. And as a matter of fact, I actually asked Mr. Clegg a question in the press conference. I asked if he could point me in any cases which the Center for Equal Opportunity had advocated, had highlighted cases of racial discrimination against an ethnic minority. And the only one he could come up with is he said that they're also advocating for higher Asian enrollment in the University of Wisconsin, too. So their name is clearly a misnomer.
Yeah, so they want more.
It's very clever.
Yeah. Well, I mean, right-wing groups are really good at this, coming up with names that sound really cool so that they can tag their TV ads or whatever. But, I don't get it. I would think the University of Wisconsin, even with a I've been in Wisconsin. In fact, I'll be in Wisconsin this weekend. I'll be at Fighting Bob Fest Friday and Saturday.
We'll be there too. As a matter of fact, we'll talk about that later.
Yeah. it's going to be a hoot, and Bernie Sanders is going to be there. I mean, we're going to have a great time. Jim Hightower is going to show up, but I would think that the University of Wisconsin would be. I mean, the state's largely white. I would think that the campus is probably largely white just because in-state tuition is cheap. What's this guy's beef that there's not enough white people at the University of Wisconsin?
It is, which would definitely come to a surprise to anybody who has taken a walk around campus in the University of Wisconsin, because it is almost exclusively white people here. If I could just explain the dynamics of what's really happening here.
Sure.
So as you said, they're not suing the university right now. What they're trying to do is put pressure on the people in charge of admissions to rethink their affirmative action policies. And a very interesting thing is the director of admissions, her name is Adele Brumfield. She was appointed to a position a few years ago, and she is an African American woman, and she's staunchly opposed to conservative action, affirmative action. She's very much against it. And
as in she's a conservative, or as in she just has a particular problem with that?
Political point of views, but in terms of affirmative action, she's very strongly against affirmative action.
Okay.
And so what is happening here is they are trying to create a big outcry, and they know that nothing's going to happen in the courtroom because this university does not use quotas, and it has been established that it is legal to look to use race as a factor in admissions as long as there are no quotas.
Right. U of M, yeah.
So what they're doing is putting pressure on the faculty, people like Adele Brumfield, and creating a climate in which they can they do not have unlimited power of this because of shared governance, right. But they're creating a climate in which the CEO is hoping that these administrators will be able to cave in to what this public pressure they create and destroy any affirmative action at the University of Wisconsin.
Don't you think this is just a stunt on their part to raise money and visibility for their own, right-wing, pathetic, racist organization?
I think that they are doing this in a lot of other cases. They're very committed to ending affirmative action, so I do think that they are interested in more than raising money. But, I mean, name recognition never hurts.
Yeah. It's really astounding. I mean, you look at the wealth disparities between white families and families of people of color. Average African-American family in the United States in the neighborhood of $5,000 to $8,000 in total wealth. Average Caucasian family in the United States of America, between $80,000 and $100,000, depending on which point in time you look at, before the Bush crash or after the Bush crash. But still, the ratio is huge. I mean, it's in the neighborhood of 15 to 1. And it seems that there needs to be some way to clean that up. And affirmative action, however you call it, is like step one. What is the university's position on this, David? We have just a minute left. We're talking about David Vines at the University of Wisconsin.
Again, the university does not have any kind of, it says on the website that they do not have any kind of point system for even for SAT scores or for grade point average.
There's so there's nothing
number to get into the university. It is a tiered approach that looks at every applicant's application.
Then what is this guy yelling about?
It looks at he's nothing because they know that they have no legal standing. Again, this is all about.
Is he yelling about the fact that there's a couple of black people on the campus? I mean, is that the hey look, there's one.
The only thing he's doing is he's creating, there's nothing illegal happening with the admissions practice of the University of Wisconsin. He knows that. That's why they're not bringing about a suit. This is entirely about creating pressure for administrators in order to, they have people on the inside or people, they have allies
right.
within the university who want to end this policy.
Absolutely incredible.
And what they're trying to do right now is nothing, not a legal case, but trying to create enough pressure. Creating a public outcry, and then they can move forward with this agenda.
Amazing. David Vines, political science major at the University of Wisconsin. David, good luck.
Thank you for having me on. I hope I see you this.
Thank you for the great reporting. Good talking with you. And also HuffingtonPost.com.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live on commercial stations from coast to coast on Sirius XM all across the North American continent, on Pacifica stations in America, Europe, and Africa, on American Forces Radio, on every U.S. military base in the world, and simulcast as television on both Dish Network and DirecTV and cable systems nationwide. And Anthony Summers is on the line with us. Anthony Summers is the biographer, investigative journalist, documentary filmmaker, author of numerous books. His latest, The 11th Day, The Full Story of 9/11 and Osama bin Laden, with his co-author Robin Swan. And his website, Anthony Summers, SUMMERS.com. Anthony, welcome to the program.
Hello there.
Great to have you with us. You have written just some absolutely brilliant and groundbreaking books, your biography of J. Edgar Hoover, Marilyn Monroe, the first book on the Kennedy assassination, and so on. I find it fascinating that you've decided to go on, you know, after Osama bin Laden and you know, the 11th day, the full story of 9/11. In this piece in, was it Vanity Fair?
There was a major extract in Vanity Fair a couple of weeks ago, yeah.
Yeah, the extract. You write that just 2 weeks before the 9/11 hijackers slammed into the Pentagon and the World Trade Center, members of a Saudi family abruptly vacated their luxury home near Sarasota.
That is last week's story, and that was, in fact, in the Miami Herald. This is very recent reporting by me.
Okay, so you know, I'm curious, you know, in a broader sense, what you think is the largest story here that most Americans don't know and that you'd like to share with us. But is this that? Is this piece of that? Or, you know, what's going on here?
I think the largest story is indeed that most Americans, I think, believe that the hijackers acted on their own under the tutelage of Osama bin Laden and Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, better known these days as KSM, because Khalid Sheikh Mohammed is so much of a mouthful, and that it all came out of the mountains of Afghanistan and was really the brainchild of merely religious, crazed religious zealots. I think that's the general impression that I get, that most Americans think.
Right.
It seems that it wasn't as simple as that. That there was support, hard to know quite the extent, but support to some degree by other powers. There was some support from Iran. Not surprisingly, Iran leans in general in direction of terrorism against the United States. But it may be that in the case of Iran, it extended only to letting the future hijackers, the terrorists, travel across Iranian borders without having their passports stamped.
Mm.
Very important, because if you have an Iranian stamp in your passport, you're far more likely to be really toughly turned over by U.S. immigration.
Yeah. Now, does this mean that the Iranian authorities knew that they were planning on doing what we call 9/11, or just that they were...
There are those who allege that. but it doesn't necessarily mean that.
Okay.
But far more significant to me is the role of Saudi Arabia, the United States' supposed ally since the Second World War. An ally, yes, in terms of business and oil, but the at a level, there are two levels of apparent Saudi assistance. One is that for years before 9/11, known named Saudi princes paid what, if we were talking about the mafia at this lunchtime, we would call protection money. Paid money on the basically on the basis of don't attack us and we'll look after you.
Mm-hmm.
And the dues went to Osama bin Laden and Al Qaeda. But in the field, it was discovered by Congress's joint inquiry that when the first two future hijackers arrived in the United States without any English, complete aliens to Western culture, they were helped by known Saudis, one of them a guy who'd been thought for years to be a Saudi intelligence agent. This was essentially withheld from the congressional inquiry by the FBI, which and the inquiry investigators stumbled on it on their own. What I have done in the last couple of weeks is to develop a very similar story in Florida, where the three of the four pilot hijackers learned to fly at Venice, just south of Sarasota. There, in a gated community at Sarasota, lived a Saudi couple. The house was owned by the father of the young woman in the couple. They left on August the 30th, just about 2 weeks before 9/11, and they left the house, best described by the counterterrorism agent and another significant witness whom I interviewed. They left the house as if they'd just gone to the movies. They left dirty diapers in the bathroom, three cars in the driveway, one of them a brand new car registered only the previous week. It was as though they'd gone to the movies, gone out grocery shopping. And this was reported to the authorities after 9/11, and after lengthy research, it was found that the three locally trained future pilot hijackers, that's Atta, Ziad Jarrah, and Marwan al-Shehi, had come and gone from that house in the 5 months before 9/11.
This is all they were training at the flight school in Florida?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And the... what has happened to the family that had rented that house or owned that house?
Well, the people who'd been living in it, a man called Al-Hiji and his wife Anoud, left on August the 30th. They left and flew back to Saudi Arabia via Arlington, Virginia. But the owners of the house were a couple called Ghazawi, Isam Ghazawi, and his American-born wife, Deborah Ghazawi.
Mm-hmm.
They are also back in Saudi Arabia. The daughter, while living in the house, told neighbors, rather arrogantly, they remember, that we're very important, you know, in Saudi Arabia. We have connections with the Saudi royal family.
Mm-hmm.
There is an Isam Ghazawi, not necessarily, but I think quite likely, not necessarily the same man, who at one point was known to have been a financier for one of the senior Saudi princes.
So are you suggesting that there's an association between the Saudi government and 9/11?
One must be very careful here, not jump to conclusions. That's the nature of the work that I do. But it is clear from all the work we've done writing the 11th day over the last 5 years, it is clear that there was a split in the Saudi family, that in the Saudi royal family, which is a very large royal family, but at a high level in the Saudi family, there were those who didn't want to, as it were, rock the oil boat. And there were those who wanted to use their millions to pursue the Wahhabi zealous religious position, which is very firmly, as is the whole country, against Israel and for the recovery of Jerusalem. And as I said earlier in this conversation this morning, some members of the royal family paid millions in official money to Al Qaeda and to Osama bin Laden in the way of protection money. Don't try to hit the regime in Saudi Arabia, and we will look after you with funds.
Right. I'd like to get into this the 11th day. Anthony, is it possible you could stay with us until the bottom of the hour for the next 15 minutes?
For 10 of those minutes would be fine.
For 10 of those. Okay.
Yes, as long as I can go away at half past, yes.
Okay, at half past, yeah, absolutely. It'll be 27 past.
Okay.
Hold on just a sec. We just have to take a break here for our commercial stations. We'll be right back. We're talking with Anthony Summers, anthonysummers.com, his website.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
He is the author of the new book, The 11th Day, The Full Story of 9/11 and Osama bin Laden, along with Robin Swan. We'll be right back with more from Anthony Summers.
Have you forgotten when those towers fell? We had neighbors still inside.
Take it back to mainstream media, 3 hours a day, 5 days a week. Tom Hartman here with you. Anthony Summers on the line with us, the biographer, investigative journalist, documentary filmmaker, author of numerous books, his most recent, The 11th Day, The Full Story of 9/11 and Osama bin Laden, anthonysummers.com, his website, Summers spelled like the season. Anthony, what is the 11th? Why the 11th day is the title?
Well, it September the 11th was the day of 9/11. It was easy. It's very unusual. I've, as you know, and as you've kindly said, I've done, and this will be my eighth book, and titles, in my experience, are things that get debated all the way to the last moment.
Yeah.
And tossed backwards and forwards and shouted down by colleagues and then decided on, because you've got to have one at the last minute.
Mm.
And this one, I came up with the first afternoon we started working on the idea of writing a book about 9/11. It has a sort of ring to it. It was the 11th day. It gives it an almost, that's the wrong word, but biblical with a small, very small b,
sure,
sort of feeling. And it stayed. We've called it the 11th day, but I think more important than the title is to say what we attempted to do.
Mm-hmm.
I was in the United States on 9/11. I was in California working on a completely different project. And I got myself to New York as fast as I could, which was, I think, about 2.5 days later.
Mm-hmm.
I think the back end of Thursday I made it. I went down to 9/11 and used my press part and my lies to get very close to what was going on, and knew then that I wanted to write about this. It had the feel immediately of a world event that I needed to know about.
Right.
And then time passed and the other project consumed my time. And then 5 years later, I decided with my co-author and wife, Robin Swan, that we would try to do the story. And things had very much changed by then, because conspiracy fever, the truthers, as they call themselves, or people call them, were in full swing. And all sorts of, frankly, loopy theories were going around. Some that seemed, at least on their face, less loopy, suggesting that explosives had somehow been involved in the bringing down of the Twin Towers of the Trade Center, and a loopy one, one that we got shot off fairly quickly, which was the idea that planes did not actually hit the Pentagon, that it had been a missile and so on.
Right.
But most important, I found that across the world, not just in the United States, millions of people had somehow got lost in the fog of all these theories. And I wanted to shake the theories, see if they held water at all, and then find out as near as possible what happened, what the truth was about 9/11. And the tragedy, I think, is that for many people, is that millions of people have, even if they don't believe the truly silly conspiracy theories, have the feeling that something's been hidden from them.
Sure.
About 9/11. And the conspiracy theories have contributed to obscuring what really matters and the real questions.
Right. And some of these in the just 2 minutes we have left here, or three at the most. For example, this today is the anniversary of the rounding up of the family of Osama bin Laden in the United States and shipping them out of the United States. Correct me if I'm wrong. There is a story that George Bush Sr. was having breakfast with a member of the Saudi family when 9/11 happened. That George Bush Jr.
I think one must be very careful about that. Of course, there is a business link. There was a business link way back between George W.'s father and the Saudis, and indeed between the former President Bush and himself and Saudi in connection with the oil business.
Right. He was bailed out by one of them.
Yes, but the suggestion that the Saudis were allowed to leave the country before the airways were open again, it does not fly. I checked it very, very carefully, and in fact, by the time they were allowed to leave the country, the planes were flying again, and charter aircraft, which is what the Saudis used to get out of the country, were allowed to fly. What is far more important, and was forgotten in the rush to tell that faulty story, is that many of those who left, including, in particular, the members of the bin Laden family who were allowed to leave, were not properly questioned by the FBI. And that is serious.
Mm-hmm. And why?
They were just given a free pass to go. I'm not privy to why.
This is something that came down out of the State Department, the White House?
I don't think it was like that. It's certainly clear, however, that they were not ordered to make sure that all the questions were asked. Remember, it was very early days. You can yourself remember the confusion and the chaos of those days.
Sure.
I think a lot of history should not be parsed too much. One can try, and if one finds sinister things in the background, then there are sinister things there. But my impression is that there was a call from the Saudi ambassador, that word came down from the White House that they should not be detained here once the airways were opened, and that then, with the FBI having an enormous amount of myriad other things to do in terms of the investigation, and it was the biggest investigation, I think, of all time in the FBI, topping even the investigation that followed the JF Kennedy assassination. And I think maybe you could put it down to inefficiency. I've certainly seen no suggestion that anyone deliberately said, don't question members of the bin Laden family.
Very interesting. Or incompetence or whatever.
Yeah.
Anthony Summers, his new book, The 11th Day, The Full Story of 9/11 and Osama bin Laden, with his co-author Robin Swan. AnthonySummers.com, and, of course, in bookstores, Twitter, Robin, R-O-B-B-Y-N-S-W-A-N. Anthony, thanks so much for being with us today.
Thank you.
Great speaking with you.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
27 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. We will be right back. Welcome back. 34 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. In just a moment, I will have in my hot little hands the official Republican talking points. So you need not bother listening to Sean Hannity's radio show today. Thank you, Jacob. And it's the official Republican talking points being distributed to radio talk show hosts all across America about President Obama's jobs bill. Yep. This is RNC, the Republican National Committee Communications Research Briefing, the Obama's Job Act, they're referring to it as. Get that? As in possessive of Obama. In other words, it's the Job Act to keep Obama's job. President Obama continues his politically important push to sell his failed policies in battleground Ohio. Just the subhead full of all this stuff. Obama is insisting his second stimulus be passed right away, but it's becoming clear that it will be less successful than the first. In other words, this is son of stimulus. And then the company say Obama's job plan won't cause them to hire. Linda Spinelli, an unemployed construction manager. I did not hear anything in the speech that would help me specifically. Flashback, one Ohio teacher who stood with Obama when he signed his last plan to save teachers, lost her job shortly thereafter. And on it goes. I mean, it's mostly picky stuff. You know, I can imagine, you know, right-wing talk show hosts turning this into 3 hours, and I'm guessing that probably 90% of them will. And, but, you know, the bottom line is that this actually is an important piece of legislation that nonpartisan experts, forget the RNC talking points that went out to all the right-wing talk show hosts this morning, nonpartisan experts, like, you know, Mark Zandi, the economist, the chief economist at Moody's, say that this is going to create 2 million American jobs. 1.9, I think, was the number that he put out. It's just common sense that if you put people back to work, you're creating jobs, and they spend money in the economy, and that stimulates the economy. And beyond that, our country is falling apart. So they're saying, you know, yeah, Republicans want to work together. Yeah, but this bill is not a compromise. This is I had this conversation last night with Karen Finney. I think this is a really important one. If the Republicans say yes to Obama and they pass his bill, this is the position they find themselves in, which is why they're pushing back so hard using their giant echo chamber, Fox News and all the right-wing talk show hosts. If they say yes to him and they pass this, they lose in 2012 because the economy will recover significantly and he will look like a hero. If they say no to him, then he has immunized himself from the bad economy in 2012 by being able to say, you know, the economy would have been better if these guys had just passed my damn jobs bill, but they wouldn't. So you need to throw the bums out. And I mean, you know, Harry Truman, when he ran against the Knew-Nothing Congress in 1948, it was over 40 years before Republicans took control of the House of Representatives again. He gave him such a thumping. But if the president responds to the Republicans who are saying right now, Eric Cantor, John Boehner, all of them, they're saying right now, oh, yeah, there's a few things in here we like. There's other things that we don't like. There's some things we'd like to take out. There's some things we'd like to change. Let's compromise. If the president compromises on this, as much as I would like him to compromise by taking out the free trade agreements, you know, that ain't going to happen. If he compromises, then he loses, in my opinion, politically. He loses both with his base, and he loses also with the independent voters who think of him as a guy who, you know, doesn't have strong principles. I mean, even when people are wrong, if they stand up for what they believe in, George W. Bush, war in Iraq, case in point, even when they're wrong, you know, even when they've been proved to be war criminals and outed CIA agents, they're running around saying, yeah, what I did, I'd do it again. Dick Cheney, case in point. There are Americans who respect that. So, anyhow, Rick in Yokohama, Japan. Hey, Rick, thanks for watching us on the web on TomHartman.com. What's up?
Hey, Tom, thanks a lot for taking my call, man. You've been piquing my interest all night, every day, on a regular basis.
Yeah, it's night there in Japan now, isn't it?
Oh, it's, we're talking like 2-something in the morning. Yeah.
Wow.
Okay. Yeah, well, I'm a late nighter anyway. So
okay, so what's up?
You know, you keep me up, and I'm retired military, 20 years, and that's about 1999 I retired. And what I saw changing, you were talking about the contracting situation and outsourcing to corporations, and I was one of those guys that were, you know, mopping floors and cutting potatoes and doing the things that you're talking about.
Right.
And in the Navy, in naval aviation, we call it TAD, temporary assigned duty, right?
Right.
You got the other guys, planes and this, that, and the other. But you know what? As a supervisor, being in a position
that I was able to actually see the transition of the U.S. government going from a point where they actually took the option of the military doing the job and giving it to civilian cooperation. And this was in, now remember, I was in from 1979 to 1999.
Right.
So me, Reagan, and Clinton, and HW, we were all there together.
Yeah.
Okay? So, and I want your listeners to understand this. And if there are any military listeners out there, they can definitely confirm and understand what I'm saying. You know, it was a calculated incident. It was not, and, oh, let's just go by the way the economy's running. No, it was calculated.
Mm-hmm.
It was calculated to a point where we had a situation where we had an aircraft, and I was in naval aviation. We had an aircraft that had a problem, and we saw the problem, and we went to Grumman. And guess what? Grumman Aircraft Corporation out of Bethpage, New York, had a solution already. They had a solution. They came up with a piece of equipment. They threw it out there, and I'm like, wait a minute, hold on. Wait a minute. Why didn't you pass this to us in the beginning? Now, my point,
in other words, they knew they had a defective product.
Exactly. Point. Point. And I dealt with that for 20 years.
Yeah.
For 20 years, Tom. So it's simply a carryover. It's simply a carryover. And the thing about it is, you know, the Graham-Rudman Act, you might remember that?
Yeah.
The Graham-Rudman Act.
Right.
And they're talking, we're going to scale down, we're going to do this, that, and the other. But all it did was expand
the contractors. Sure.
Exactly.
Sure. It was all about, and which is why Phil Graham was all gung-ho for it. And co-sponsored it, and because it was, you know, let's give more money to the private corporations. I mean, you know, his wife was on the board of Enron. I mean, it's like,
exactly right. I was a witness to the whole program.
Yeah, amazing.
I was there. I lived it, Tom.
Yeah,
I lived it. And to this day, here I am now. I'm living in Japan. I'm retired 12 years now. And you know what? And seeing what's happening right now, everything that you say is so correct and spot on that, you know, I called you about a year ago, and I dealt with I deal here with the Democrat Republics abroad.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And, you know, and we talked a little bit, and I was talking about gay marriage at that time, and yeah, which I think, you know, gay marriage is simply, you know, it's a civil union. It's not a religious act.
Sure.
And so the thing is, you know, how they have transpired and put the, I'm on the outside looking in, Tom, because I'm living outside of the U.S.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So I have a totally different perspective, and I'm not inundated by the right-wing media, you know, whatever you want to call it. I'm just not inundated by it.
Yeah.
I have an option.
You don't get Fox News in Japan?
Say again?
Do you get Fox News in Japan? My friend Jerry, who spends part of the year in Brazil, that's the only American news he can get on the local TV station is Fox.
No, I avoid it. I'm internet savvy, so.
Okay, I see.
I have options.
Yeah.
And I use them wisely, Tom. I use them wisely. And I'm a very rational person, okay? And I want your listeners and especially yourself, because you are, and your callers tell you, you know, they get an education from you. I get an education from you. Big time. I'm telling you right now, they're just smiling.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much. Rick, we're out of time, but thank you for your kind words, and thanks for the confirmation that I'm not nuts. I appreciate it. It's and your perspective, and particularly on the military contractors. This is a real problem. And thank you for watching us in Yokohama, Japan. We will be right back, 45 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
More of your calls and thoughts. Plus, we'll be checking in with the Talk Radio News Service, TalkRadioNews.com, right after this.
I'm trying to be somebody.
Welcome back. 9.5 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Ellen Ratner on the line, or not on the line. She's in the studio with us. She's sitting right next to me here. And Ellen has a new book out. Well, we're going to actually talk about this next week because
it's not, it's officially not out.
Yeah, it's not officially out yet. So we will get into that next week. Ellen, what's going on in the world?
Okay, well, there's actually a lot going on in Washington, D.C. The Congressional Super Committee, this committee of 12, met today, heard some testimony. They're really being pushed in two directions. One direction is saying cut more than $1.5 trillion. And Steve Elmendorf, who's director of the Congressional Budget Office, which is a nonpartisan budget office, is saying, look, things are going to have to get worse before it gets better. We're going to have to increase taxes, and we're going to have to spend to get the economy going. So the debt will actually go more. But, of course, Republicans don't want to hear that, but that is what he said today to the committee. But, not welcome news by some.
Well, it's not welcome news because if it's not actually things getting worse before they get better. It's like things have to get better. You know, the economy has to get better in order to put people back to work.
Well, he said the deficit would get worse.
Right, the deficit has to get worse, but the economy gets better so that people start taking paychecks. So instead of taking unemployment, they are paying taxes. And, you know, that helps the over the long term, that helps everything. But it also helps President Obama get reelected, which is really why the Republicans are upset about it.
They're flipping out. Meanwhile, of course, today, and there's going to be some hearings on this, as well as, of course, some press conferences. But the Census Bureau came out with their report. I'm sitting here with the executive part of the report on income, poverty, and health insurance coverage in the United States, 2010. The official poverty rate in 2010, which is this year, because it was based on last year, was 15.1%. It went up from 14.3%. It's the third consecutive annual increase in the poverty rate.
Right.
And the number of people without health insurance coverage rose from 49 million to 49.9 million. They're saying that that is not a statistical difference. Of course, it's almost a million people.
Yeah.
So it depends.
Women, a few human beings here.
Women, actually, that's right, who worked full-time year-round were still earning 77% of that for men that are working year-round. And median income declined for white and black households between 2009 and 2010. For Asian and Hispanics, it stayed about the same. Doubled-up households. That's our households that included at least one additional person who is not enrolled in school. So it's a family member or somebody like that. And that has had an increase by about 2 million since last year.
Wow.
So people are doubling up. Also, the number of people 25 to 34 who resided in their parents' household compared to last year actually went up 2.4 percentage points, almost 5 million people. Are residing with their parents.
It's almost like it's a replay. My aunt, Aunt Doris, had this big old house up in Charlevoix, Michigan, with a whole bunch of bedrooms. And their family had a fair amount of money going into the Great Depression. They got wiped out by the Great Depression, but they still had the house. She turned it into a B&B. It was still a B&B when I was a little kid in the 60s, until she got too old to handle it.
Right.
They sold it. But, you know, from the 30s until the 60s, that's what people did. If they had an extra bedroom, they rented it out.
That's right.
And that's happening increasingly in the United States, apparently.
Well, very, very much so.
And
so you have that group, and then you have kids living with their parents over 25, and that increased by 2 million. That's a lot of people.
That is a lot of people.
Okay. And it's a lot of people who then are also not buying into the rental housing market or even for starter homes, that
right.
kind of thing.
Right.
So that whole, you take 2 million people out of the housing market,
right.
and that
further slows things down.
It further slows things down. That's right.
Right.
Also, the president, as you know, unveiled his legislation yesterday. Interesting. I don't know if you know some of the fine details, but he would raise $40 billion. He's saying it will pay for itself by ending the oil and gas deductions on domestic drilling and $18 billion by taxing investment fund managers and income tax rate instead of the capital gains rate.
Wow.
I know. Yeah. Well, I agree with
you. So our subsidy, everybody's been saying we've been subsidizing the oil industry to the tune of $3 billion a year. You're saying it's 40?
They are saying that what I'm saying is that in the president's new legislation, he's going to save $40 billion a year by ending. It's 40 over the period of
over 10 years.
Yeah,
so it's in the neighborhood of $4 billion
right.
a year. Yeah.
And he also would raise $3 billion from changing the tax treatment of corporate jets, which, as you know, has been
Mitch McConnell's very upset about that.
I'm sure. And also, today, Carl Levin had his committee. He said to the Pentagon,
Senator
from Michigan,
Democrat.
Look, take that $400 billion that we talked about you're saving in the Pentagon budget, and I want to see a plan for it. We haven't seen a plan, so it's time you guys got us a plan.
Now, who did he say this to?
He said this to the Pentagon folks who were testifying at his committee, people.
Oh, that's very interesting. I didn't know that the Pentagon was claiming that they were going to save, you know, $0.4 trillion.
They were basically ordered to do that.
Oh, I see.
Over 10 years, $40 billion a year. But
So put it together. The last I heard, the Pentagon is like missing $2 trillion. Is that still the case?
You know, I'll have to ask our Pentagon correspondent about it. I mean, I do remember when Senator Kennedy was alive, he talked about billions of dollars going in, literally money would be going on these huge planks in planes to Iraq. And by the way, speaking of Iraq, State Department today just issued a new warning for travel to Iraq.
Oh, my.
Yes.
Yeah.
I don't know if we have a time.
We have 1 minute.
Bobby Jindal says that he
Governor
is
of Louisiana.
Governor of Louisiana. Even though he is supporting Rick Perry, he said he's not going to be his VP. Well, it's not so surprising. I'm sure they're not going to pick him because they're not going to pick two Southern governors. He said that he had offered to support Perry, but he was not going to be his VP. That's not exactly breaking news. Also, Romania. The Romanians are in town today, and they are going to be signing an agreement of a legally binding agreement for establishment of a U.S. land-based SM-3 ballistic missile defense system in that part of Europe.
Very
Eastern
interesting.
Europe.
In Eastern Europe.
That's right.
Very interesting. Okay, Victoria Jones. Ellen Radner of the Talk Radio News Service. Thank you, Ellen.
Thank you.
Great to have you. Maggie Fox up next, President and CEO of the Climate Reality Project.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Okay, right this moment, officially, the extent of the Arctic summer sea ice is at a new record low level. Much like Texas just hit a new record high for the highest temperatures over the months of the summer. New data indicates the continuation of a long-term decline in summer ice underway since at least 1979. Researchers say roughly half that decline can be attributed to global warming, at least half that decline. Maggie Fox is on the line with us. She is the president and CEO of the Climate Reality Project. ClimateRealityProject.org is the website. And Maggie, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you, Tom. I'm really happy to be here.
Thank you for joining us. Tell us, what is the Climate Reality Project?
Well, it's an organization founded and chaired by Al Gore, and devoted exclusively to focusing on waking people up and engaging in the solutions to solve the climate crisis.
It saddens me to hear that for us to be having this conversation in a way, because aren't we pretty much the only developed country in the world where you have to wake people up to this?
Well, not entirely. We're one of three. So we aren't.
Are there two other countries that have politics corrupted by big money?
Are Australia and the United Kingdom. But I would say that the denier industry in the United States is the best funded and the most focused.
Right. And so, to say the very least. And yet, nonetheless, the message is starting to get through.
Yes, it is. We're hosting an event this week, tomorrow night at 7 p.m. Central. We are hosting an event, 24 Hours of Reality, in which we are focusing through a new slide presentation that Al has prepared on extreme weather events that have occurred just in the last year all around the world, including in the United States, where We've seen, you know, the fires in Texas and the incredible heat waves all through the United States, the Midwestern floods, you know, Hurricane Irene. To date, just in September of this year, we've amassed a bill of over $1 billion in infrastructure damage just from extreme weather events, and that's in the U.S. alone. When you look around the rest of the world in the last year, I don't even have the number yet for the kind of dollars it's costing us to keep denying the existence of climate change.
The last time, I've pretty much stopped debating these guys, but Mark Morano used to come on our show a lot 2, 3, 4 years ago and debate climate change with me.
Right.
And the statistic that I, or the thing that I would find would always pretty much stop him or the other guys cold in their tracks was when Swiss Re, which is the company based out of Switzerland, basically it's reinvestment. They basically back, or reinsurance rather. They basically back up insurance companies. So if an insurance company has $100 billion worth of policies out there, and they've got $5 billion in the bank, if a genuine disaster happens, they're wiped out. And so they buy insurance that they themselves don't get wiped out. And for the companies that were doing insurance on things like floods and tornadoes and, you know, these kinds of extreme weather events, Swiss Re was just starting to jack up their prices like crazy because they were just coming right out and saying, and this was years ago,
statement after public statement that climate change is happening, that it's affecting their business and the world, and that denial is not an option, and they are not denying it. They've changed their entire business practices as a result.
Well, I was wondering, it's been a few years since I really, got into that, because I had to debate somebody who was, pretty knowledgeable or whatever, had a lot of numbers and things to throw at me.
Right.
What is the status of the business side of this, and the human side of this, the actual cost? There, obviously, if there are people who say, well, we're building more along the seacoast, we never should have done that, or buildings are more expensive, there's been inflation. This goes way beyond that.
Well, we actually haven't, I don't know the exact cost, but I can tell you that the most important phenomena that exists in anticipation of our event and the quarterly events that we are beginning with this one tomorrow night is that there's this odd disconnect between business behavior around the world and individual behavior around the world and how our governments are behaving.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Okay.
You see individuals, even those that are somewhat skeptical, are still making decisions around vehicles and personal consumer choices. Businesses are doing quite impressive sustainability plans, global businesses, community businesses, multi-state businesses, accepting climate change while we live in a political environment of denial. So that's both the bad news and the good news. The bad news is that inculcated in our cultures all around the world is an understanding that this change is happening. But we have an infrastructure of denial feeding doubt and denial and stopping our political leaders from taking the kind of policy changes that we need to do. So we've created this event. It starts tomorrow night, and go on our website, www.climaterealityproject.org, and tune in, because we're actually doing 24 hours of reality, starting in Mexico City at 7 p.m. Central and moving westward. Every hour on the hour is a different country, making a presentation around extreme weather events, both in that country and a core slideshow that Al created about extreme weather events that are occurring all over the world. It ends in New York at 7 p.m. on the night of the 15th, Al's presentation. He will not only give the slideshow, but he will also do a wrap-up of all the 23 hours prior to that. He'll be awake for all 24 hours.
Yikes.
Yes, as will most of us. Well, it's pretty exciting because in each one of these countries, Tom, a very remarkable individual has stepped up to pull together an event that we will be live streaming and filming. But it's a real live event in that country. I guess today my most inspirational moment is of a young man in Pakistan who was trained by Al, and on the Inconvenient Truth slideshow, he's going back to his home village and pulling together people who are survivors of the intense Pakistani floods in 2010, many of whom are still displaced, some situation similar to Haiti where the massive shifts that occurred in that country are so profound that here we are a year later and not much has changed.
Right.
pulling together survivors of the flood, and he reached out to the mobile phone company in Pakistan, and they've agreed to do 1 million text messages to individuals who have accounts with them who actually have the ability to have a computer link. So they will sign up with us in Pakistan. I mean, that's almost justification alone for doing this event. Just think about that message resonating all throughout Pakistan. And we have people in London and in Auckland and in Canberra, the parliament in Australia. There was a carbon legislation introduced yesterday and a real chance that the first carbon legislation in the world will pass in Australia by the end of this year. Mm-hmm. We have presenters in the archipelago north of Victoria that's going underwater as a result of sea level rise, with some of the native people who live there and who will lose their homeland. The same will be true further north at Kotzebue. There will be in a longhouse in an Inuit village where those villagers are already looking for a new home because sea level rise has already begun, inundated some of the most central parts of the village. You know, we're in Iceland, where one of the presenters is a trained musician who works on sustainability and will be speaking in Icelandic. Mm-hmm. In Turkey, it'll be an individual who works on an online directory for sustainable choices. So when you think about this, when you think about these individuals and you think about the businesses all over the world, our job is to stand up to the denial and the doubt and move government policy while still encouraging individuals to make those important personal decisions that they can and should be making.
Remarkable. Very, very well done. And Maggie L. Fox, the president and CEO of the Climate Reality Project. Get over to the website, climaterealityproject.org, and tag it, put it in your favorite spots or whatever, starting at 7 p.m. on September 14th Eastern Time, 7 p.m. Eastern Time. It begins. Maggie, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Tom. Thanks so much.
And
take
best
care.
Of luck on this. Keep us
take
up to date.
Tune in.
This
okay,
is
we'll
Tom
do.
Tom Hartman Program.
Thank you again. We'll be right back. It's 15 minutes past the hour on the Tom Hartman Program. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. A little, you know, this could be the future of America. So some of these clips from last night's so-called debate, I would call it a beauty pageant. But, you know, I suppose there was a bit of an argument, arguably. Actually, even before I get to that, I got to tell you this story. This is pretty amazing. Here, first of all, this is clip number six, Chris. This is Congressman Daryl Issa. One of the few members of the House of Representatives who actually is a criminal. I mean, actually has a criminal past. And he's also the second richest member of the House of Representatives, Daryl Issa, with his car alarm company, where he manufactures his car alarms offshore in other countries in Asia. He now has this to say.
Whether or not the federal government borrows money from overseas sources to keep teachers in XYZ state on the payroll seems to be stimulus too. I don't think that belongs in this stimulus bill. I don't think we should be maintaining government workers with borrowed money.
So now Lee Fong over at the Center for American Progress is reporting that a group called the American Family Voices has filed a formal ethics complaint against Daryl Issa. He's the head of the Government Oversight Committee, so he's got the power basically to call anybody before his committee and harass the hell out of him, which he's been doing. This is the guy, this is the small-time crook who's, you know, from California. This is the guy who thought, this is the guy who paid, you know, almost $1 million of his own money to get Gray Davis unseated because he thought he was going to run for governor. And then when he discovered that Ken Lay and Arnold Schwarzenegger had a secret deal, and that Schwarzenegger was going to be the candidate, you know, literally broke down in tears on national television. He lost his chance to be governor of California. But now he's one of the most powerful members of the House of Representatives. They filed a formal ethics complaint against him, saying that, for example, he purchased millions of dollars worth of high-yield Goldman Sachs mutual funds. At the same time, that he's pressuring the Securities and Exchange Commission to drop a lawsuit against, guess who? Goldman Sachs for defrauding investors. You get this? This is a sitting member of Congress. And this is an ethics complaint. This should be a criminal investigation by the Department of Justice. The letter highlights Peter Haller, a former Goldman Sachs VP who went to work for the Oversight Committee, that is for Daryl Issa, and used his power to pressure bank regulators to ease up on Dodd-Frank rules. Dodd-Frank is the piece of legislation that says, you know, banksters, fool me once, shame on me, or shame on you. Fool me, you can't get fooled again. It's to paraphrase George W. Bush. And, you know, Dodd-Frank says, you know, we're going to put some rational limits on these banksters. So one of the vice presidents of Goldman Sachs quits his job and goes to work for Daryl Issa's committee at a rather substantial drop in pay. I guarantee you that will be made up. This is part of the ethics complaint. And the letter revisits a controversial earmark. Here's, you know, Daryl Issa owns some land in Vista, California, a whole bunch of it. And if he could only get a road by there, you know, suddenly the value would go up because, you know, you could then turn into a shopping center or something. You could make a pile of money. And the taxpayer project would have enhanced the value of several lucrative office buildings owned by Issa. Daryl Issa, one of the most corrupt members of Congress, one of the few members of Congress who's actually has a criminal past, and one of the richest members of the House of Representatives. It's really quite remarkable. John in San Luis Obispo. Hey, John, what's up?
Hey, not much time. I won't take up a lot of time. I just want to remind anyone that's on the central coast of California near San Luis Obispo, tomorrow night at the Ludwig Community Center at 864 Santa Rosa Street, we have a Move to Amend California tour featuring David Cobb as a speaker.
That's great.
From 7 p.m. Yeah, and he's the spokesperson for Move to Amend, obviously, the constitutional amendment to abolish the corporate personhood deal that the Supreme Court came up with. I just want to get it all out there. If you're listening, please, San Luis Obispo people, please show up at the Ludwig Community Center, 864 Santa Rosa Street in San Luis Obispo. It's from 7 to 9 p.m. tomorrow night. I'm providing free cinnamon rolls. There's going to be great coffee there, locally provided.
Free cinnamon rolls. John, am I correct in assuming that there's information about this at movetoamend.org?
Absolutely.
Okay, great.
Absolutely.
People can check it out.
There. Just look for the town there. I think it's the third one down when you go to it, and it's going to be great.
Okay.
It's going to be fantastic.
John, you got it out. Great. Thank you very much for the call, and good on you for your activism. I wish you the very best. God bless you. Shane in Missoula, Montana. Hey, Shane, what's up?
Yes, thanks for taking my call, Tom. I was just listening to the last guest you had on with the climate reality, and I just was wondering, with the whole climate change topic, why no one ever talks about things like geoengineering, controlling the weather. There's plenty of documents out there talking about how it's been done. Mm-hmm. Since the 60s.
Well, the Chinese made sure that it didn't rain during the Olympics by seeding clouds.
And, you know, I'm here in Missoula today. I'm watching planes fly overhead and dropping what most would argue would be contrails, but they don't go away ever. They hover over the sun. They, you know, I'm not sure how to discuss this without sounding like a crazy person, but...
That's okay to sound like a crazy person.
Sulfur aerosols, geoengineering.
Yeah. No, people can Google that. Just
back in 09, yeah. And instead of
Shane, thank you. We're out of time. But if people want to, if they want more information on this, I don't endorse your theory, but I respect you for going for it. Just Google contrails. You'll get it all. Shane, thanks a lot. Thanks for watching us in Missoula, Montana. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Up next, the good, the bad, and the incredibly ugly, and your calls. Stick around. Yep, that would be the good, the bad, and the very, very lectually ugly. Brought to you by EdisonFactor.com. Food for your brain. The good. Minnesota Attorney General Lori Swanson. The American people have a new ally in their fight against the banksters. While most of the attorneys general in the nation are working with the White House and Wall Street to give banksters blanket immunity from future investigations into their high crimes, in exchange for a small fine, of course, Attorney General Swanson is saying, no way! She's joined with New York Attorney General Eric Schneiderman and three other attorneys general, to push for more investigations and more accountability. As she said, the banks should not be released from liability for conduct that has not been investigated and is not appropriately remedied in any settlement. She said, any settlement between government regulators and the mortgage industry should have teeth holding the banks accountable for their wrongful conduct. The American people have waited for too long for justice on Wall Street. Let's hope the efforts of attorneys general like Lori Swanson are successful. The bad, Steve Ducey. In regard to the president's push to close tax loopholes for corporate jet owners and stop the corporate welfare checks to oil companies to pay for his Jobs Act, Fox and Friends talking head Ducey said, it's class warfare. It's one of those suck the rich things. Looks like Ducey got the morning memo from Roger Ailes to kick up the class warfare rhetoric today. Here's a question for Ducey. How is cutting off oil subsidies for oil companies class warfare? But cutting off subsidies for poor people to buy food is just fine. As Warren Buffett said, there is class warfare, all right. And it's his class, the rich class, that's winning. And Buffett can thank pea brains like Steve Ducey for it. And the very, very ugly ZXE, the corporation formerly known as Blackwater. Besides deploying private mercenary armies around the world from Iraq to post-Katrina New Orleans, Blackwater is now developing a video game so kids can join in the bloody shootouts, too. The game, entitled Blackwater, will allow players to control a mercenary army fighting off a civil war in a North African town. Eric Prince, the CEO of Blackwater, said, I believe Blackwater will have a unique appeal to gamers. The physical, visual, and virtual feel of participating in a mission brings a level of excitement and realism to a game that is hard to match, and frankly, it's fun. I think gamers will really enjoy playing a game. Unclear if the Iraqi massacre mission, for which Eric Prince has yet to be held to account, will be included in the new video game. But nonetheless, it's very, very ugly. Wow. That is really, think about that for a minute. That is really quite extraordinary. Wayne in Jacksonville, Illinois. Hey, Wayne, what's on your mind?
Well, you've led into it very beautifully here. The retired sailor who called from Japan a while ago made me wonder about something, and that is with the troops pretty well with U.S. military pretty well withdrawn from Iraq, that makes me wonder how many private contractors we have left there. It seems to me like that number has increased gradually throughout our involvement.
Yes.
Do you know offhand what that number is?
I believe that the total troop number is around 50,000 and the total private contractor number is around 70, but I may be way off on that. That's a number that I recall from months ago, and where it stands right now, I don't know.
Okay,
I do know that that in both Afghanistan and Iraq, private contractors outnumber our troops.
Okay, and that's so even with our involvement in Iraq, supposedly at a minimum, we're still bankrolling a mercenary army of occupation there, it sounds like.
Well, we have built a city, basically. I mean, you know, it's larger than the Vatican. We've built we call it the Iraqi embassy, but it's the largest U.S. embassy on the planet. It's an entire self-contained city with its own theaters, its own shopping malls, its own restaurants, its own housing, its everything. I mean, you know, on the Tigris and Euphrates rivers there. And, you know, in the old green zone in Saddam, you know, where Saddam used to live in his bunker. And so there's a lot of people living there, a lot of people working there. There's a lot of security for that. There are also, I mean, you know, to give them their due, there are some contractors who are helping rebuild hospitals and schools and doing things that, frankly, I think that we probably should do.
We could have just sent them there to begin with.
I'm speaking well of those contractors like they're doing decent work, but frankly, I don't think that our contractors should be rebuilding Iraq. After World War II, We didn't send Bechtel or Halliburton over to Germany to rebuild Germany. We gave them the money and we said, you guys rebuild your own infrastructure. And so they made their own cement plants and they made their own steel plants, which we'd just bombed to hell. And they rebuilt their own fabrication facilities and their own, and what it did was it not only rebuilt Germany, but it also provided the basis for a resurgent, industrial economy. We should be giving money to Iraqi contractors. There are, I realize many of them have fled the country in the diaspora. There's 5 million displaced people in that country, 2.5 million, 3 million of them internal to the country, and another about an equal number who have actually just fled Iraq altogether. Many of them, the educated class who had the money to flee. But we should be saying, okay, we'll provide the funds. You hire your own engineers. You hire, build your own cement factories. Make your own buildings. Build your own buildings, make your own steel, and, we should be doing the same thing. We need a new Marshall Plan for these guys rather than enriching U.S. contractors, frankly. But, yeah, Wayne, you raise a very good point. Thank you very much for calling and bringing it up. Karen in Midway, Ohio. Hey, Karen, what's up?
Well, I had just had a thought, and I hope that just one person that was in that audience that yelled out that they should let a 30-year-old man without insurance die before we helped him looks inside of them and asks them how they can claim to believe in pro-life and telling women that they cannot have abortions.
Yeah, there does seem to be a disconnect there, doesn't there?
Same people saying these things.
Yeah.
The same people. Where is their Christian God if they're shouting out, let somebody die? I have a husband who doesn't have health insurance and desperately needs it. And they're saying he can just crawl up in a hole and die before they'd help him, but they'll tell my neighbor that she can't have an abortion. Because they're pro-life.
Yeah, I think that we should disconnect the two, and because there are many people who are pro-life who are, in fact, many Democrats who are pro-life. There's a whole pro-life Democratic movement, who are anti-abortion, basically. But there is a huge overlap on the right, in particular, on the hard right, between the let's kill abortion doctors and let's let people die. Without any help, I acknowledge that. Karen, thank you very much. And just lest you not know what Karen's talking about, clip number two here, Chris, this is Ron Paul last night at the debate. Wolf Blitzer asked him, so what do you do if a 30-year-old guy who, this is the age bracket, right? People in the 20s and 30s where they typically don't have health insurance because they're healthy. They think they're going to live forever. They save the money. So, but he's in a coma, and help yourself. Yeah, right. He's in a coma. So here's the interchange.
A healthy 30-year-old young man has a good job, makes a good living, but decides, I'm not going to spend $200 or $300 a month for health insurance because I'm healthy. I don't need it. But, something terrible happens. All of a sudden, he needs it. Who's going to pay for if he goes into a coma, for example? Who pays for that?
In a society that you accept welfareism and socialism, he expects the government to take care of
him. What do you want?
But what he should do is whatever he wants to do and assume responsibility for himself. My advice to him would have a major medical policy, but not before.
But he doesn't have that. He doesn't have it, and he needs intensive care for 6 months. Who pays?
That's what freedom is all about, taking your own risk. This whole idea that you have to prepare and take care of everybody.
But, Congressman, are you saying the society should just let him die?
No.
Yeah, that's the Tea Party crowd. Yes! Let him die! Are you saying we should just let him die?
No.
Yeah, there you go. Steve in North Troy, Vermont. Hey, Steve, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Greetings from the home of the Northern Lights. Yeah, it shows a lack of empathy and of ethics.
Yes, I agree.
When we were talking about the massive amounts of cash going to Iraq last week, it brought to mind the Fed policy. I think it was in 2005 that the Fed stopped counting M3, which is all the money in circulation.
Right.
And I always wondered.
They stopped counting it, or they just stopped talking about it? I thought that they were still being calculated.
I believe they stopped counting it, and they didn't factor it in. And it was right about the same time they started shipping the money overseas.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah, there was a pile of $100 bills on pallets large enough to be seen from outer space that was shipped into Iraq that has largely vanished. Interesting and excellent point. Thank you very much for making it, Steve, and good to hear from you. Loretta in Tucson, Arizona. Hey, Loretta, what's up?
Hi, Tom. I have a few bones to pick with Al Gore and some of the and actually the lady that was just on your show, Maggie Fox.
With climaterealityproject.org. Okay.
Right. I'm very happy they're out there trying to educate the public and politicians, but they don't emphasize the major point behind climate change. We have basically changed the planet. My daughter's an oceanographer, and she is studying the way of the ocean and atmosphere interact. The problem with climate change is that these groups kind of infer that if we do all the right things, things will someday go back to normal. But we have a new normal.
Yes.
The planet has changed.
You're right. You're absolutely right. The oceans are acidifying. The atmosphere has 5% more moisture in it now than it did when Ronald Reagan was elected, thus the more severe storms. You're absolutely right, Loretta, and we need to be planning for that new normal. We also need to make sure that we don't get into a new normal that's even far worse. Thank you, Loretta.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Indeed. And what is the true Tea Party agenda? Greg in Victorville thinks he knows. We'll be back with him. And by the way, you can get over to freespeech.org and sign the petition to expand free speech's reach. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And our crazy alert for the day. Stay away from Shirley. A Malaysian orangutan named Shirley gained notoriety at her zoo when she was often caught smoking cigarettes handed to her by visitors. But now Malaysian wildlife officials are forcing Shirley to quit cold turkey. She's been removed from the zoo due to poor living conditions and is being denied cigarettes because, as the zoo director said, smoking is not a normal behavior for orangutans. According to the group Nature Alert, Shirley seemed to have already grown addicted to the cancer sticks, suffering severe mood swings and looking very agitated when she wasn't smoking. I guess that's going to derail RJR's new marketing campaign featuring the Marlboro monkey. Yeah, it's a joke. Okay, Greg in Victorville, California. You know the true Tea Party agenda?
Yes, Tom, thanks for taking my phone call. Let me just say I'm a real big fan of yours, Tom. I called you a couple months ago, and I think the smartest people, not just as a progressive, but just in general.
Thank you.
I don't know if we'll be in a world without you there, Tom. But, yes, I think that not only do they obviously, they clearly say they want to get rid of Social Security and, you know, get rid of Medicare, Medicaid, things like that. But I also think they want to get rid of the Civil Rights Act and the Voter Rights Act as well, because
Paul
has said in the past that he thinks the Civil Rights Act is unconstitutional. And Governor Perry wrote in his book, Fed Up, and thought it was unconstitutional as well. And I can tell you, Tom, as an African-American, that scares the heck out of me.
Yep.
When I hear them, you know, say things like that. I mean, I just think that they really, I mean, if they can get, I mean, if they can get a guy in there, I think they truly are going to do it. Because I know, Tom, you discussed as well that actually this has been part of their agenda for a while now with, you know, with Reagan and, you know, everyone like that.
Well, look at what they're doing. I'm sorry, Greg. Continue.
Yeah, because I know he campaigned for Barry Goldwater in 1964, and I've been telling a lot of other people that as well. I mean, that's been true part of their agenda for years now.
Yeah, and Goldwater, you know, was opposed to the Voting Rights Act and the Civil Rights Act. Although Barry Goldwater's position to his defense was a little more nuanced. Goldwater owned a department store in Phoenix called Goldwater's. He inherited it from his father. His father died when he was in his 20s, and at the age of 27, he was managing it. And he, and this was in the 1950s, and he integrated the store and, in other words, took off the whites only entrance sign and, you know, that kind of stuff. He integrated the store and he integrated the staff when he was running the business. So he was a fairly enlightened businessman for his day for the 50s. He genuinely thought that there was that the 10th Amendment required the states to do this. I think he was wrong. History shows he was wrong. But I don't think that Barry Goldwater's opposition was based on racism. On the other hand, when Ronald Reagan kicks off his presidential campaign by giving a speech about states' rights in Philadelphia, Mississippi, where, you know, three civil rights workers were notoriously murdered. You know, they made a movie out of it, Mississippi Burning. You get what's really going on. And I'll tell you, they don't even need to do away with the Civil Rights Act or the Voting Rights Act. They're already doing it. You've got, you know, over a dozen states now that have laws on the books like Wisconsin just passed that say that if you don't have a driver's license, you can't vote. And in urban areas, I mean, I live here in Washington, D.C., and Louise and I sold our car when we moved here. I got no car. I got no reason to drive. I really have no reason to have a driver's license other than I have to get on an airplane from time to time. And I can understand somebody living here, growing up their whole life. One of my best friends lives in New York City. He's lived his whole life there. I don't know if he has a driver's license. And so people in urban settings, which tend to be disproportionately either liberals, you know, who live in big cities, or people of color who are living in big cities, are not going to be able to vote. And that's already going on. So the you combine that with, you know, what the crazy lady did down in Kathleen Harris did down in Florida and in the election of 2000, you know, with George W. Bush knocking 80,000 African Americans off the voting rolls because felons in Texas had similar names to these people in, you know, common African American names in Florida. The campaign to disenfranchise people of color and people of poverty, people of, you know, the class war and the race war is well underway, Greg. I'm telling you, it's well underway. So thank you for calling and pointing it out and giving me a chance to rant about it. Becky in Tampa, Florida. Hey, Becky, what's on your mind?
Hi, I'd like to follow up on one of your earlier callers who was talking about pro-lifers who are against abortion, but they'll let a 30-year-old man die who doesn't have insurance.
Right.
I don't see how pro-lifers can also be pro-war.
Yeah, and in fact, I know some. I keep coming back to this. I think that the hypocrisy of many of the Republicans who use being pro-life simply as another flag to wave is something that we need to call out. On the other hand, there are people of good conscience who are opposed to abortion and not necessarily opposed to criminalizing all abortion, but they're just opposed to abortion. And they're opposed to the death penalty, and they're opposed to war, and they think that everybody should have national health care. I know several of those people personally. So, you know, I can just, and as I said, there's a national organization of Democrat, pro-life Democrats. And they're using basically that kind of a rationale. So, I'm not sure that it was the pro-lifers who were yelling, you know, let them die. I think it was just the crazies, the followers. And thank you, Becky, for the call. The followers of Ron Paul. It's, you know, the libertarians. I call them Republicans who want to smoke dope and get laid. But it goes beyond that. It's a cult. Libertarianism is a cult in the United States. It's right up there with Lyndon LaRouche and Reverend Moon. And the problem is that it's a cult that, to a large extent, has a chokehold on much of the Republican Party. So, anyhow, don't forget, democracy begins when you show up and participate. Get out there, get active, tag, you're it. We'll see you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to tomhartman.com.